I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
This week, Sebastian Foakes on his latest novel, Snow Country. Sebastian Foakes's books include Paris Echo, Where the Heart Used to Be, Human Traces, On Green Dolphin Street, Engleby, Birdsong, and the number one bestseller, A Week in December. And today we're going to be talking about Sebastian's latest book, which is Snow Country. Sebastian, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you very much.
Tell us, first of all, how you would describe Snow Country.
I would describe it as a novel which hopes to make you think about things, some things which are quite philosophical, quite interesting, quite big questions about what kind of creatures human beings are, but which at the same time is a very tightly focused story about the lives of three or four people. And at its heart, I would say it's really quite a simple love story.
And it's also a, well, the second part of a proposed trilogy. Your previous book, Human Traces, which is also set in a key location of this novel. As you say at the beginning of this novel, both books can easily be read separately. This is a standalone story, but some of the protagonists of that first novel do hang rather heavily over the characters in this novel. So tell us how the two are connected.
Well, the first thing to say is that it's a very ambitious and rather silly thing to say you're going to write a trilogy. I mean, I might be run over by a tram tomorrow. I might be get COVID. I seem to have escaped it so far, but who knows? And there's 15 years have passed since Human Traces came out. And as one of the reviewers said, it's quite surprising to see somebody return after such a long time. But I think that I knew when I had finished Human Traces, even though it's a very long book, that there were still ideas in it that would bear looking at again. And what I was saying before, really, the very strange nature of the human creature. It's not something that any number of books or any number of writers, whether they're coming at it from a scientific or a medical or a philosophical point of view, are ever really going to get to the end of. So I knew I would want to come back at some point. The relationship of the two books, in my view, it's probably better to read Snow Country first, because it's a slightly shorter and slightly easier book in some ways to approach. And then if you like it, which I hope people will, they can then say, right, now we'll see the people who are referred to and who have just small walk-on parts in Snow Country. Let's go back and find out what they were like as young people. That's the sort of fun thing you can do in fiction, which for obvious reasons you can't do in real life. I mean, I quite often, when I meet someone in their 40s or 50s or 60s, imagine what they were like as children. And it would be really fun to meet them when they were either 12 or 19 or 21. And in fiction, you can do that. So I think that's one connection. And the connections between the books are really thematic. They're going to be about the same ideas. But there are one or two characters who recur. But if you've been, my rule of thumb is that I don't want to be writing sequels, because otherwise people who haven't read the first one say, well, I'm not going to bother with this one. This is emphatically not a sequel. And if you've been a big character in one, you can only have a walk-on in another one.
Well, the big ideas that you cover in this book, indeed, you've written about similar ideas elsewhere. I was going to say it didn't have to be in the same setting. You could have explored those ideas in another setting, but you have chosen to set this in the same setting. So I wanted to talk about Austria fundamentally. What is it about Austria and this particular setting that interests you?
I think I was drawn to it in the first place for two reasons. One, very simply, that a friend of mine, his mother's family is Austrian, and I went to stay with him once in her old summer house by a lake in the southern part of Austria called Carinthia in the southeast near the border with Slovenia. And I was staying in a hotel across the way because the little summer house on the lake was only had one bedroom. And the hotel I was staying in was a very nice building built around a courtyard with a fountain and then a sort of gallery upstairs. And it just rather set my mind racing. And I find this quite often with books that, you know, you think you're going to plan them all in a very orderly way and you're going to work out what they're going to be about first. And then you'll work out the kind of characters you need. And finally, you know, the action is to make all that come together. But in reality, it's much less orderly than that. You see a building or a courtyard or a room, a light behind a window, and you think, oh, yeah, now that's interesting. Now, I wonder what happened there. And suddenly your mind starts working in a way that makes things come alive for you. So it was partly that. And then, of course, I mean, I was thinking this is about 23 years ago now, I suppose. I was also thinking then about writing a book about the early days of psychiatry and of psychoanalysis and what we had learned, if anything, since then. And of course, Vienna in the 1890s and then the first two decades of the 20th century was really the hub of a lot of this thought and exploration. So for those two reasons, I was drawn to Austria. And then this book, Snow Country, is set. It starts in 1910, before the First World War, and it ends in 1934, when a civil war breaks out in Austria. And all this is it's pretty interesting, really. It's the old world of 1910. And in 1934, Hitler's just been elected in Germany. So it's the beginning of a completely new age. And, you know, Austrian history shows this in pretty graphic, easy to follow and interesting ways.
And so it would seem then that this hotel you stayed in at that time becomes eventually the Schloss Seebeck, which is the central sanatorium in this story. It sounds very much like it. This is the sanatorium that's set up by Thomas and Jack, the characters from Human Traces, the previous novel. And we now find it, you know, much later in the early 20th century. So tell us about this Schloss, what it is, what's going on there.
It's a sanatorium, and it's for people with nervous ailments, as it was called in those days, neurasthenia, but also people with more serious mental illness. And in Britain and France and Italy, in the middle of the 19th century, the medical profession and the government decided they needed to get to grips with the whole idea of mental illness, madness, or lunacy, as it was known in this country then. And they set up this great asylum system in which people were invited to bring in members of their family, friends, neighbors who were suffering. And they were put into these huge Victorian asylums. Every county had one or two. But the trouble was that although this was an enterprise which started off with a great philanthropic and hopeful intent, once they got all these hundreds and thousands of people there, they realized they didn't really know what the matter was with any of them, still less how to cure it. And they, over the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, these places became sort of dumping grounds, really, where people that society found difficult to deal with would be deposited. And some of these people were suffering from senile dementia or alcohol dependency. Some were suffering from what we would now call psychosis or schizophrenia. Some were simply depressed. Some were troublesome in other ways, or had organic disease like epilepsy, and some were just were blind or deaf or just difficult to deal with. And so in Human Traces, two very young, very idealistic men, one French called Jacques and one English called Thomas, decide that this is no good at all, and they want to really get to the bottom of what is this problem with humanity? Why are we afflicted by so many of these odd illnesses and diseases and malfunctions which other creatures don't seem to have? And so this is a marvelous pioneering adventure, romantic adventure, quixotic adventure, really, that they set up, and each trains rigorously, one in England, one in Paris. And then they put their thoughts together and they rent, they take a lease on this big building near a lake in Austria. And the idea is that they'll take lots of rich people who are suffering from, you know, quite mild nervous exhaustion and things like that. And with the fees that they charge them, they will do a great deal of research into treating the causes of the more seriously ill patients who tend to be from poorer families. So it really is a sort of huge philanthropic venture. That's the background of the Schloss Seeblick.
Anton Heideck, who is one of our two main protagonists in this story, tell us something about who he is.
So Snow Country starts, as I think I said, in 1910, and Anton is a young man who has come to Vienna to go to the university. And he comes from a very bourgeois family. The family business is making sausages, and they come from a sort of provincial town in Styria, a part of Austria. And when he arrives in Vienna, Anton is rather shocked by the decadent life he finds there, notably the number of prostitutes who line the streets. And in those days, the police would draw or paint a line along the middle of the pavement, and the girls had to stand on the building side of it so that respectable passers-by could walk in peace without being molested. But this coincides, of course, with a lot of very serious psychological speculation about the right way to live, about sex, character, gender, and so on, which is being published. Many writers in Vienna are publishing at this time. And of course, there is a very lively artistic, musical, cultural scene going on. Anton isn't particularly interested in any of that. And he decides to make himself into a reporter. He doesn't want to be a great writer or musician, but he thinks that he could find a niche for himself reporting on the deeds of others. And the other thing he really wants to do is find a way of fitting in, finding a way of making himself feel valuable as a male in his relations with women. And like most young men, he's pretty hopeless at this. He's clumsy and inept and inexperienced, and it's quite hard for him to find his way forward. But, you know, he's a persevering kind of fellow.
And then eventually he meets Delphine, who is French and older than him and considerably more experienced.
Yes, he has to support himself as a student by private tutoring. His family won't pay for him because they want him to do law or medicine. And he says, no, he wants to do philosophy. They say, well, fine, but you have to support yourself. Which is a very common middle-class attitude, I think, in every country, in every generation. And one of his tutoring jobs is in a very smart part of Vienna, and he's tutoring a young boy who's extremely dull and backward pupil. But there's a governess working in this enormous apartment called Delphine, who's an older, as you say, older woman in her, he thinks in her early 30s, but she's even a little older than that, actually. And he falls for her very hard and very heavily. And she eventually falls for him, too, though she tries to warn him that her past is not perhaps, you know, is not unblemished. But he's so carried away by the physical aspect of things that he barely listens to her when she tries to explain. What happens to them is what happens to people, characters a lot in my books, which is that they're very focused on their own passions and their own lives and their own feelings. And the big movements of history go on all around them and have an effect on them that they are not immediately aware of. And in August 1914, Anton finds himself in Paris reporting on a story, a very scandalous real life story of how the Minister of Finance's wife, so like the Chancellor of the Exchequer's wife, Mrs. Rishi Sunak, as it were, went into the office of the editor of the Figaro and shot him dead through the heart. And this was all to do with sexual relations and adultery and so on and so forth, and the possibility of the emergence of scandalous letters. But what it means is that the whole of Paris was thinking about sex and violence rather than about the war, which was about to plunge the whole of Europe into darkness a week later. Anton is stuck in Paris when war breaks out, and Delphine, who is French, is stuck in Vienna. And as you can imagine, I don't want to give away the plot, but this causes complications for them.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Sebastian Folks, and we're talking about his latest novel, Snow Country. And as you said, Sebastian, the First World War breaks out, the Great War. It's 1914, and Anton goes away and fights. And although the book doesn't focus too much on his experiences, clearly this massively shape who he becomes. The book leaps forward at this point to 1927, and we meet Lena, our other main protagonist. But before we talk about her, his experiences in the war, he fights in a place called Galicia. And when I first came across this in the book, I immediately thought, what? There wasn't any fighting in Spain? And so I was delighted to discover a whole area of Europe that I'd actually never heard of before. And Anton is fighting for the, you know, the former Austro-Hungarian Empire against the Russians, being in the war before the revolution. Tell us something about that conflict in that area, because it's something that I'm not familiar with at all.
Well, there was something called the Brusilov Offensive, which was reckoned to have been the most bloodthirsty and brutal episode of the whole of the First World War, which cost something like 1 million deaths. But obviously, in this country, we don't know that much about it compared to the Western Front, which is where our soldiers were fighting. And I don't go into very much detail about the war. I feel that I've been there, I've done that. You know, there is birdsong after all. But the importance of the war in Snow Country really is in the fallout from it. And again, to go back to what we were talking about before, the way that these events have a sort of a way of sneaking through unseen, like sort of rising damp into people's lives. And it's only when the plaster starts bubbling and cracking some years later that you need to look at what has been going on underneath. The reader may well feel when they meet Anton in the second part of the book that something has changed in him, and maybe he is suffering from some form of post-traumatic stress. But I leave that to him to explain through his conversations with other people and for the reader to find out, rather than I don't really lay it on very thick myself.
So let's talk about Lena then, who, as I said, is the sort of second main protagonist in the story. When we first meet her, tell us about her.
Lena is considerably younger. We meet her as a little girl when war breaks out. She's about 8, if I remember rightly. And she lives in a small town overlooking a river wharf with her mother in two rooms. And her mother is an alcoholic and unable to hold down a job, and makes ends meet by sleeping with men from the river trade or from the town. And the idea for Lena really came to me from a book I read about nursing, in which the author Christy Watson talked about various patients she had nursed, including a woman who was only happy when she was pregnant and who was also an alcoholic. And what interested me about that was, what might it be like to be the child of that woman? So that's where Lena came from. And hers is a very different background from Anton. She's very poor and has little chance in life, though through a charitable organization, she does get to go to school. She doesn't get on at all well at school. It just doesn't really take with her. And she leaves young and goes to work in a laundry of the hospital and subsequently gets a job in a shop and eventually moves to Vienna, where she's also working in a shop. And Anton's job, his project, if you like, is to find a way of living that makes him feel not superfluous, that makes him feel useful. Whereas Lena's project is really to survive. And she is a girl with not much going for her, but she does have a sense of entitlement. And she thinks that she's as good as anyone else and that she has a right to live and love and to make money and to have a life. And that is what she sets out to do. And she develops from a frightened little girl into a young woman of quite considerable resources, I think it's fair to say. And I hope that the reader will come to, don't have to like her, you don't have to love her, but I think she's worthy of some degree of respect, despite the difficult things which happened to her.
No, I agree. And I think she's a very powerful character. And indeed, her mother, who, you know, we see generally through, you know, to begin with, through Lena's eyes quite critically. But then later on, much later in the book, there's another perspective given on her mother from a neighbour who has been a long-term lover of hers and presents her in an almost heroic light, in that she is living a small life, a humble life, but a life fundamentally of pleasure seeking, which it seems in its own way a slightly revolutionary way for her to be living at that time.
Well, I think that you have to say that she's true to herself anyway. But I do like the idea of returning to characters intermittently and just seeing them from a slightly different angle. And this is, Tolstoy is the master of doing this. If you're in War and Peace, you go off to war for a few years, and when you come back, you find that the girls at home have grown up and you now see them from quite a different angle, and often not a very kind one. He's very unforgiving the way when he returns and shows you a different facet of his characters. It's really quite cruel sometimes, I think. But I prefer myself, if going back to a character, to show them in a slightly better light on revisiting and say, well, look, they may appear like this, but there's usually a reason why people are the way they are. Well, there's usually tons of reasons, but, you know, here's one or two of them.
So the reason Lena ends up in Vienna is because she becomes involved with Rudolf, a young lawyer who is also heavily involved in the political scene, sort of rather labyrinthine political scene of Vienna, something that, well, we know as a reader in the future is a doomed enterprise fundamentally. Tell us something about, you know, what would have been going on politically in Vienna in these interwar years.
Well, under the terms of the Treaty of Versailles, the Austria as it then becomes, suffers financially in the same way that Germany does. And this leads to a sort of polarization in politics, I suppose you would say. Snow Country is not immensely concerned with the politics of Austria, but it keeps it very simple. I mean, and in simple terms, what really happened was that the left wing of the country was focused on Vienna, which was a very developed socialist city, actually, with, you know, really huge amount of municipal housing estates, projects for the workers. Slums were cleared. These places had, you know, really excellent facilities and laundries and creches and so on, and high taxes, of course, in Vienna to pay for this. And the rest of Austria, which was very, very conservative, very Catholic. And so that was the essential opposition between the two. But each side had its private army. And then the government banned the private army of the left. And this precipitated showdowns ending in extreme violence in 1934, when the government actually used the army, used not just soldiers, but artillery, heavy artillery, to open fire on a sort of workers' protests and workers' occupation. As I say, we don't go into a great deal of detail about this. There's one kind of scene of action towards the end of the book. But really, the point is to get us into the mind of Rudolf, who's the other main character, who is a lawyer, who is an activist and a believer. He's a sort of idealist, and he believes he's a man of the left. He's a socialist, but he also has a religious belief. And he believes that the idea of socialism and religion can go hand in hand, which puts him at odds with the rest of the left wing in Vienna, who are atheist. So that's a way of looking at these ideas. But it's his relation with Lena. That's the dynamo, as far as he's concerned, as a character. And his relationship with her is, well, it's complicated. Does he love her? Does he fancy her? Does he want to be with her? What does she feel for him? It's not always completely clear, is it?
No, indeed. At the end of the book, there's an afterword where you mention the influence of another book called Snow Country by the Nobel Prize-winning Japanese novelist Kawabata. And I wonder, in what way was that novel an influence on this one?
The basic way was I just pinched his title, which is a title I liked very much. And it wasn't really called Snow Country when Kawabata wrote it. He called it Yukiguni. And Snow Country was an English name given to it in the 50s. And Kawabata died a long time ago. So my hope was that, in 1972, in fact, my hope was that he had no further use for this title. But I do pay a homage to him in one passage in the book, which describes Lena arriving one night under heavy snow at the local station before where she is to take up her new job as a maid at this sanatorium. So that's a sort of politeness, really, to a great writer who went before. But it was also, it's just such a beautiful scene in his book that I wanted to take my hat off to him, really.
Just one more thing then, and then I'll get you to read us a bit of the book if you would. Are we going to wait another 15 years for the third one?
I don't think I can risk waiting another 15 years. I sort of know what's going to be in it. Funnily enough, it's rather crystallized in my mind in the last few weeks as I've been touring around talking about Snow Country. I think I now see what is left to say, and I think I now see vaguely how to say it. So my plan is to write another book first, which will be a very contemporary, rather high concept novel set in modern day or even slightly future England. And then I'll go, and then the next one I'll do will be the third and final part of the Austrian trilogy, God willing, if we're all spared.
Indeed, indeed. Can I get you to read us a bit then?
Yes, this is a little bit which it's very hard reading from novels, really, because you have to spend so much time explaining where you are that it's hardly any time left to read. But this is a bit about two thirds of the way through the book when Anton has gone to the sanatorium to write an article about it. And he has stayed on there because he wants to receive psychotherapy himself. And he realizes that he's going to need, having booked in only for a few days, he's going to need some more shirts and more clothes to wear if he's going to stay there for another month or so. So he goes off to the local town and Lena finds herself accompanying him. And this is a little scene where we see perhaps something of each of those two. Until that instant in the draper's shop, Lena's life had been little more than a war with need, keeping herself alive while relying on the whim of others. Those others who, since the days of Lucas and Emma at school, she had distrusted. And more than distrusted, because she had had the childish but persistent suspicion that other people were not real in the inescapable way that she was, that their battles to survive were not as pressing as her own. As a result, her innate compassion had had no outlet any more than her affection. It had instead built up inside her for almost a quarter of a century. But now, hearing Anton's voice from the other room, polite yet weary, disengaged from what he was doing, she felt the swelling of an unstoppable emotion. Rising from her chair, she went into the back room where the assistant was wrapping Anton's purchases. "So that's all done," the man was saying. "For the last shirt, if you could choose between these two, the thin stripe is more classic, but the cream you can wear with anything." Anton was fingering the material on the countertop, but Lena could tell that he was not interested. "I think you should have this one," she said, pulling a blue shirt off the rail. He looked her deep in the eye as she stood with her arm outstretched, Was there a glint of recognition, she wondered, or was he merely surprised by her decisive movement? Do you have this in my size? He said. I like the colour. It would suit you, said Lena. Let me see. Yeah, yes, we do have it in your size. It's a very good quality cotton, a little more expensive than the others. Oh, that's all right. I'll take it. Thank you. Thank you, Lena. I'm not very gifted when it comes to shopping, as you can probably see. That shade of blue, said Lena. It was easy to choose.
So I've been talking to Sebastian Foulkes. We've been talking about his new novel, Snow Country, which is out in the UK from Hutchinson Heinemann. Sebastian, thank you so much for taking the time to share it with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.